All right, chapter 19, we started talking about electric potential energy and electric potential. Those are two different quantities, though they are related. The electric potential energy is any potential energy is stored energy, in this case, stored electrical energy. Okay, as I move a charge from point A to point B, okay, electric force could possibly act on it, and thereby the work done by the electrical force is given by the difference of these two electric potential energies. The electric potential is defined by the electric potential energy divided by the charge, okay, in this case, a test charge, as we were describing it. Okay, the electric potential has units of volts. Okay, and sometimes we'll just drop the electric part, just call talk about the potential, or talk about the voltage between two points in terms of the potential difference. So the potential difference is the negative of the work done divided by the charge. A little rearrangement by this means that if I have a charge that's going through a potential difference, I can compute how much work that takes. Okay. Energy conservation, we can now add a new piece to our energy conservation. This is my shortened version. Obviously, there are times that you might have some springs or other things thrown in that would contribute to other types of stored energy. So, kinetic energy, that's the gravitational potential energy, which doesn't always show up in these problems, and the electric potential energy. All right, so you compute that sum at one point. Basically, the kinetic energy plus the potential energy at a point is equal to the kinetic energy plus the potential energy at another point, providing there aren't any energy losses somewhere. The electric potential outside of a point charge, a point charge Q, if I'm some distance R away from it, is given by KQ over R. And that's as far as we had gotten, okay, in this chapter. Okay, and from first questions people had coming to me about the homework were, how do I do this problem with three charges? So the idea here is that one of the problems talks about assembling charges. All right, you start off with nothing, no charge. You pull in a charge and you place a charge here, say Q1. And the question typically is, by assembling a bunch of charges together, how much work does it take to put them there? So you have all these charges at infinity, and you start bringing some in. So we bring one charge in. There is no electric field around, and so there's no work done. So I start off. Let's see. Maybe I'll call this W1 equals 0. To bring in Q1 from infinity. Now I take another charge and I bring it in. So here I come in with Q2, and I want to put Q2 somewhere, so there's Q2. But Q2 sees the electric field due to Q1, right? Q1's got this nice electric field that's produced. I bring in Q2, and so therefore it's going to take a little effort to bring in the second charge. And so I look at the amount of work that's done. Well, out at infinity, the electric potential is 0 because that's how we set this up, right? As R gets very, very large, V gets very, very small. So when I'm talking about the potential difference, I'm talking about, right, 0 out here and something non-zero down there. So I'm going to take the difference. It's essentially going to amount to whatever the electric potential is at that point due to any charges that are there. Right now, the only charge that's here is Q1. I could see how far Q2 is from Q1. Let me call this, say, R1, that distance. This is the electric potential that Q2 sees at this point if I put in Q1 and R1 in here. So in order to compute the work that's done, okay, well, the work that's done is the difference between these two. And so what I get is essentially I'm going to get the charge, which is Q2, times some V. Say V due to charge 1. So what is that? That's going to be Q2 times K Q1 over R1. So that's how much work it takes to bring in charge Q2 all the way from infinity to a distance R1 away from Q1. So far the total work I've done is 0 plus this W2. Now I have to compute the amount of work it takes to bring in a third charge. So now I bring a third charge in and I put it somewhere. Call it Q3. So this is going to be Q3 times the electric potential that it sees. So what electric potential does it see? Well, actually, it sees these two charges, as we saw the other day. Right? The total electric potential at that point is the sum of the electric potentials from these two charges. So I have to know the electric potential from charge 1, which is going to be what I'll call this R2, because it's the second distance I'm writing down. And so that's going to give me K Q1 over R2. And then I need to look at the potential outside of Q2 at some distance. I'll call that R3.
Bless you.
So that's going to be K Q2 over R3. So if I multiply all this out, that gives me the total work done to bring the third charge in. So the work done to assemble charges is the sum of all of these. So the total work done, well, it's just W1 plus W2 plus just add those up, and voila, that's going to happen. We could write down the expression that I get for all of that, but if I write it down, I am at a risk of you memorizing it. All right? You have to think about what you're doing here. Not everything should be memorized. Yes?
With this, the charges, you do put the negative sign or the positive?
Yeah, so when I'm writing this out, the question is whether I should include the signs. And the answer is yes. So if this is a negative charge, right, if it's minus 5 coulombs, then wherever there's a Q1, there's a minus 5 coulombs. Okay. So that's how what it takes to assemble charges. Alright, so for the most part, this chapter is about electric potential and electric potential energy, so we'll move on a little. Yes?
I just got a question about R, I guess. Are you always bringing in the charge from infinity, or are they ever
going
to stay?
Okay. Yeah, that's what it means. I'm assembling them. I have this universe with no charge, and then I'm saying how much energy does it take to bring these charges in and create this distribution of charge. Okay, the next thing are equipotential surfaces. in some cases curves, depending upon how you look at it. So you mapped out equipotential curves in the lab last week. So let's start off with a charge, say a positive charge sitting here. We can map out the electric field. Radial lines. Now that's a nice two-dimensional rendition. What we really have is I have this charge sitting here, the lines are going off in this direction, right? It's a three-dimensional picture. It's not really the two-dimensional picture in the book or what I draw. All right, this is a three-dimensional picture. The electric potential outside of this charge only depends upon how far away I am. So if I'm interested in looking at 1 meter away, then I would go over 1 meter. And I would say, let's assume that's 1 meter. Okay. And I could compute what V is. And then I could go off 1 meter in this direction. And I'd get the same number, wouldn't I? And I'd go off this way, I get the same. If I come out this way 1 meter, I get the same number. So all of these points 1 meter away from here, from the charge, have the same electric potential. Okay, and that's what we mean by equipotential. We're looking at all the points that have the same potential, the same value of V. And what is the shape that I get of the surface in this case? All of these points that are 1 meter away from the given point in three dimensions is called what?
Sphere.
A sphere. Right, so I get a spherical surface. If I change my position, I get a different V. So you get, well, on my board I get circles, but we get these nice spherical surfaces, which are intersected by the radial electric field. These are the equipotential surfaces. Two dimensions curves. And we'll note that, going back to thinking about circles, essentially this line that's sitting here, this radius, is intersecting my circle at 90 degrees. We learned that in geometry. Okay, same thing. Radial lines piercing through a spherical surface pierce through perpendicular. So these electric field lines are perpendicular to the equipotential surfaces and vice versa. All right, that's perpendicular. So that's one thing that we can do. If I gave you a bunch of electric field lines for a system, you could sketch the equipotential surfaces by just going around and trying to construct something that's perpendicular. So if I have this, a bunch of these lines, I don't know, let's say I have some other orientation of lines sitting here like that, and what I could do is I could go a little perpendicular to this, a little perpendicular, a little perpendicular. They're close enough together, I can kind of get an idea as to what these curves look like for various equipotential lines. All right, so the equipotential lines are perpendicular to the electric field. Now the next thing I'd like to do is talk about what happens as I move a charge along one of these field lines. So if I move a charge from this point to that point along that field line, then we've already seen that the electric field does work on the charge. Okay. But if I were to move along this electric equipotential surface to another point, and if I were to follow this curve like that, my claim is that no work is done. Okay, now this is similar to doing work on a nice simple mass, no charges involved, even though this is metal. Okay, so the idea is if I move this object horizontal to the gravitational field, right, this is moving horizontal to the gravitational field, okay, then there's no work being done by the gravitational field. Right, it's going this way, there is work. Right? There's no change in potential gravitational potential if I move horizontally. But there is a change if I go vertically. So that's the same idea here. Okay? So if I move perpendicular to the, really the force is in the direction, right? If I have a charge here, the force is perpendicular to the displacement of the charge. Remember that when I compute work, the work is equal to the force, the magnitude of the force times the magnitude of the displacement times the cosine of the angle between them. Okay, remember that? So in that case, the work is the force times the displacement times the cosine of the angle. If gravity is acting this way and I'm moving that way, the angle is 90 degrees. So the work is 0 because the cosine of 90 is 0. Same thing here. The force is acting in the direction of the electric field lines. If I move perpendicular to that or along the example surfaces, then no work is done. So if I were to label these A, B, C, okay, then as I go from A to C along the equipotential surface, then W is 0. So that's what I'm saying. However, it's not 0 if I move from A to B. All right, so moving from A to B, I get a certain value. And then I could go through and I could put another point on here just for the fun of it. Let's call this D. So as I move from A to D, the amount of work that I do actually is going to be the same as the amount of work I do going from A to B and A to D. How much work am I doing going from B to D?
Zero.
Assuming I'm following the curve, right? That's a big assumption. I'm not taking the shortest distance between two points. Okay, so that's how you have to think about these things. And then the next question is, how does one actually compute that amount of work? Right? Because then once we compute the work, if I want to go and compute the amount of work from A to B, then that's just going to be Q, okay, times, and then I look at the electric potential at A minus the electric potential at B, and that gives me how much work I do going between from A to B. So I do, then I can go VA minus VC, but VA and VC are the same values, right? So I get 0. So now algebraically you can see that that's coming out. Okay, so those are the ideas behind looking at equipotential surfaces. I could look at another simple configuration. I could look at parallel plates. I can have positively charged plate, negatively charged plate. In this case, we know what the electric field looks like by now, right? So we have the electric field, again, staying away from the ends of the plates. There's my electric field. And now, based on what I said, what, right? And think of these are plates. I could draw it three-dimensionally. Okay. Okay, and the book does that, but I'm going to draw it two-dimensionally. Think of my place going into the board. Right, so I've taken two index cards parallel. Right there are my parallel plates. This has positive charge, that has negative charge. Okay, so where are the equipotential surfaces?
Perpendicular.
They're going to be perpendicular, so perpendicular means what? Perpendicular here, there, there. So you can see if I draw lines like this, they are lines of constant or equal potential. And since in the three-dimensional version, all that means is this is a plane. All right, so I have a plane of constant potential values. So that's what I have for that. And then I can ask questions, how much work does it take to move a charge from here to here between any pair of these lines? Okay. Well, the amount of work that it takes, actually, if I have a charge sitting here, this is a uniform electric field. Since there's a uniform electric field, that means that the force acting on the charge as I'm moving it is a constant force, right? If my displacement, let's say the distance between the two of these is delta S, that's the displacement, then I can easily compute the work as the force, the electrical force, times the displacement. Going back to physics one, right? Work is force times distance. If I am moving in the same direction as the electric field lines, then my theta is zero. Cosine of zero is one. So I'm ignoring the angle right now. Okay? But putting a charge Q inside this field, I know what Fe is from the last chapter. The charge moving in an electric field, what is the force? Let's assume that the field between these is has magnitude E. What is F?
Q times E.
Oh, there we go. Q, E. Delta S. So that's the amount of work. But we also know that the work through the electric field is given by this expression. Right? So I can solve for the work, and that's minus Q delta V. So it's minus Q times potential difference. So I have two expressions here for the work. They must be equal. So I can set these equal. Notice I can now eliminate the charge. All right, so setting these equal, I have Q E delta S is minus Q delta V. Divide out the charge. And I can solve for something. Let me solve for E. All right, so the electric field is related to the potential difference. It is minus delta V over delta S. So if I know the potential difference, say, between the plates, if I go to the extremes, because the biggest displacement I can have for this plate system is the distance between the two plates. So I could say the distance between the two plates divided into the potential difference between these two, I can tell you what the electric field would be. Okay. Or I could just say, given two equal potential lines inside for some values of delta S less than the distance, the spacing between the plates, will tell me, right, if I know what the electric field is, I could then solve and tell you what the difference in potentials are here. And so there's all kinds of little things I can do with this. Delta V over delta S is called a potential gradient. See this being used later when we actually know what the spacing is between the plates. How do I set up an electric potential difference? As I mentioned the other day, I can connect a battery to this. I can connect these plates to the positive terminal, that to the negative terminal, set up a voltage difference across the plates, okay, and thus establish an electric field. Now, in general, this value that I get for E is not the value of the electric field between any two given equipotential surfaces, but it's the component along the direction of delta S. So I could do the same thing here if I know what the separation is, but it will give me the component of the electric field in this direction. We like numbers. Do something with some numbers. Okay, two plates. But again, it establishes the idea that I connect a 9-volt battery between these plates, right? These plates will get some charge, an electric field will be set up, and the question is, how big is this field? All right, so that's just a simple plug-in, and I get, now it depends which way I set this up as far as direction, but we'll just plug this in. This is 9 volts divided by 0.05 meters. And what do I get? Notice something funny with this. What's different about this than any other computation of electric field we've done so far? The units are different. This is volts per meter. What have our units been?
Coulombs per
meter.
Newtons.
What?
Newtons, joules, etc.
Well, electric field. Those newtons per coulomb. Okay? Does that bother you? Yeah. Whatever Dr. Herman says, whatever. I'll put it on the test. Well, sometimes you have to worry about these things, right? Turns out that in some circumstances, volts per meters will come out. Let's look at 1 volt per meter and look at 1 newton per coulomb. Is there any way we can relate these? All right, let's see. What's a volt? So if I come over here, we defined a volt from this. Volt was energy per charge. What are the units of energy per charge?
Joules per coulomb.
Okay, that's equal to 1 joule per coulomb. What are the units of joules? Let's break these down into the most basic kind of units. What's another way to write a joule?
Kilograms times meters per second.
Okay, good. So we come back here. Work is in joules, force is in newtons, distance is in meters, right? So we've learned way back in like chapter 6 that 1 joule is a newton meter. Okay, so this is 1 newton meter. Whoops, I forgot my meters. You didn't tell me that. Now, I could break it down further, but you can kind of see already that I've got a newton per coulomb, which is what I was aiming for, right? So 1 volt per meter is the same as 1 newton per coulomb. So now we don't have to worry anymore. Okay? So sometimes you have to check your units and make sure, okay, that these are actually the same. Yes.
In your example, why did you drop the negative sign?
I just didn't write it. But if I'm interested in just the magnitude of V, I don't need the negative sign. Okay. Okay. What other things can we do? All right, the rest of the chapter is devoted to what are known as capacitors. Okay. A capacitor is actually an electrical device that stores electrical energy. Okay. So far we have seen things like this, right? Two parallel plates. That's an example of a capacitor. Okay, where we have two conductors that are near each other but not touching. So, two conductors close to each other, like the parallel plates. As you may recall in the book, when they introduced parallel plates, they actually said parallel plate capacitor. But I wasn't quite ready to talk about capacitors then, so I was only looking at parallel plates. We can now throw in the word capacitor. So they don't have to be planes. All right, there are things that are spherical capacitors. So I could have a conductor that's a spherical shell, and I can have one a little bigger than that. Have them have opposite charges and look at the electric field between them. I could have cylinders, okay? Two metallic cylinders, one inside another, like big tin cans, all right? And I could set those up. So there are various ways of doing this. In fact, a real capacitor, okay, you could think of as a parallel plate. They're typically made with very thin foil, and then in order to use them in devices that you can carry around with you, right? And I mean, the areas of these things are huge, right? You don't want to carry something around that's really big. And so they're packed up nice and tight. And they put material in between them because, after all, it's hard to keep a vacuum between two plates. At this point, all I've said, I haven't said anything about what's between these plates, right? Essentially, there's a vacuum here, there's nothing in there. And that's kind of hard to do realistically. And so if you put material inside, we could say often filled with insulators or insulating material or insulating media, dielectrics. Well, let's look at the ideal one first with no dielectric. So the idea is that I have these parallel surfaces, and we typically will put, say, a positive charge on one and a negative charge on the other, and we have stored some electrical energy. Now, by establishing these, I just went through a whole discussion here how it not only produces an electric field, but you have an electric potential difference across these plates. Instead of writing delta V at this point, we're just going to say that the electric potential difference across these two plates is V. We're going to drop the delta sign now. Okay. Where I say that the voltage across the plates is given by that. Okay, if I connect a battery, as I suggested in the last example, then I ended up with these charges distributed on the plates. And then we see that the amount of charge is proportional to the voltage across the plate. So if I increase the voltage, the charge goes up. All right, so I can put a battery with a knob on it, turn a dial, and crank up the voltage. All right, and thus I'm cranking up the amount of charge that's sitting on here. So since it's been found that the charge is proportional to the voltage, we could write down that the charge is equal to a constant times the voltage. This particular plates, this is called the capacitance. We're going to use this in chapter 20 as we put capacitors in circuits and see what the effect on circuits are. The capacitance has units. If I look at Q over V, what do I get for a unit? If I solve this for C, Q over V. Units of charge? Coulomb. Units of voltage?
Volt.
So 1 coulomb per volt. This is actually given a name, as many useful units are. This is called 1 farad. Capital F for farad. Farad is short for Faraday, whom some of you may have heard before. All right, Michael Faraday was famous for doing kinds of chemistry experiments and things. He used to go to these royal meetings of the sciences and things. He took notes. He took such meticulous notes that they gave him a job. He didn't even have a job at the time. And then they stored him down in the basement for years. Okay, but he took tons of experiments, was very meticulous in his note keeping. But we'll hear about Faraday again in a couple of chapters when we talk about electromagnetism. Okay. Unfortunately, the place where he was is, I think it just announced this week that they're taking the building down at the Royal Society. So. But anyway, Faraday is one of our famous chemists would like to claim him. He did a lot of things in chemistry, electrochemistry. So, but anyway, so Farad. is a unit of capacitance. Okay. All right, so what else can we do? We can introduce a dielectric now. What happens if I put some real stuff in here besides a vacuum? Well, real stuff is made up of atoms. Okay, and so if I come over here and add a dielectric, then we get the following kind of picture. Okay, let's say I have positive charges on this plate. I have negative charges on the other plate. And we know that if there is no material inside, that there's an electric field that gets established across these plates. Now let me call this E sub zero to designate the electric field with no dielectric. Okay, now you have a sense that something's going to change when I put a dielectric in. Okay, so you put in some stuff here, it's got atoms, right? What do atoms have in them?
Electrons and protons.
Electrons and protons. Okay, they're little charges. So if I have an electron sitting here, what's going to happen to the electron in this electric field?
It's going to be drawn to the positive.
It's going to be drawn where? To the positive. So electrons are going to be drawn this way. What about protons? They're going to be drawn the other way. Now, they're not necessarily going to be torn apart, right? We're assuming we don't have fields that are going to tear apart the material that's inside. All right, so they're bound in these little atoms. But the electrons favor being in this direction, and the protons favor being in the other direction. So you see little pictures that look like this. What's essentially happening is it's setting up a dipole. All right? Remember, a dipole, we have two equal but opposite charges. So we have these little mini dipoles that are being set up. And some materials naturally like to have a dipole nature. Other cases, it's just the redistribution of the charge, even if it's slight. And many pictures look something like this. We look at all the atoms. This is a magnified version, right? Very cartoonish, which essentially tells me that we have more favorability of negative this way, positive that way. And you could imagine all the stuff on the inside canceling, so that the overall effect is, now, this medium that I have here has sort of an overall negative on this side and an overall positive over here. But it's not very strong, so it's not going to match the electric field that's being produced by these plates. Okay, but it kind of looks like parallel plates all by itself. At least the overall effect. And so we sort of have a little opposing electric field due to the realignment of the atoms, of the charges. All right? So that little realignment added with the original electric field give me a total electric field, all right, which if I take this piece and I whack off part of that, then I'm going to get the total electric field of these plates plus the stuff inside. I can indicate by a vector of some length, and the electric field without the dielectric is bigger. And so basically the electric field is reduced by putting in some real material in between the plates. Okay, so that's the idea. If I look at the ratio of the electric field with nothing over the electric field I get when I have a dielectric, that ratio is given the letter kappa, Greek K, and that's called the dielectric constant. What does that typically have? It's bigger than one. So that'll give you an idea of which, what ratio you'll have here. Right? Because without the dielectric, you're going to get a bigger electric field than with it. So that dielectric constant comes into play if I want to say write down what the capacitance is, because after all, what's going to happen, it's going to affect what the capacitance is. And if it affects the capacitance, then the amount of voltage I put across here will affect how much charge will actually appear on the plates. Okay. And so that's the type of thing that we want to look at. All right, so how do things change when I have a dielectric in the material? All right, so let's see. We know that Q is equal to CV. So this is a measured quantity. So I go ahead and I put in a certain voltage and I see what the charge is, and that gives me the capacitance, right? I can plot Q versus V if I can measure the charge. I can sit there and count the charges. I have some way of counting charge right on the plates, and I can do that. Okay. We also know that the electric field, when there's nothing in there, okay, is related to the voltage across here and the distance between the plates. So let's say that the distance between these two plates is little d. So instead of delta S like I was doing before, now we're switching to little d. So if I look at this, and now I'm just going to look at the magnitude, right, E is just going to be V over D. So E is equal to V, over D. So the magnitude of this field, right, where plates are separated, that's my maximum, delta S is D, and this holds true. That's what I get if there's no dielectric material. Now, if I have dielectric material, I can come over to this and rewrite that. Let's see, E0 is equal to kappa times E. Let's see, is that how I wanted to do that? E0, I have to go way back to last week to write down what E0 is. If I have two plates like this, okay, and I have charge Q and a negative Q on here, right, there's a relationship between Q and E. What is the relationship between Q and E in this case? Well, if you remember, E was sigma over epsilon 0. You remember that? And sigma was the charge per area. So if I know the area of the plates, right, then basically I have the following, right? E is sigma over epsilon 0, but sigma is Q divided by A, so that's Q over epsilon 0 A. And so now you can see I'm bringing in the surface area of the plates. So what I can do is combine these. E0 is kappa E. I can put V over D in for E. And I can put this other expression in for E0 and rearrange things. So let's see. E0 is Q over epsilon 0 A. Kappa E is a voltage divided by D. what I would get for the, when I have a dielectric. And now, a little rearranging, I can solve for Q. And I get Q is equal to, let's see, what do I have? Kappa epsilon 0 A divided by D. So that takes care of the epsilon 0, the A, the kappa, the D. The only thing left is the voltage. And what do I have? I have Q is proportional to the voltage. What is that stuff in the parentheses?
Capacitance.
All right, so the capacitance, when I have a dielectric, is given by kappa epsilon 0 A over D. You'll see the capacitance is proportional to the area of the plates or the surface of the conductor, depending upon, right now we're just visualizing the plates. Okay, so if I know the surface area, if I want a higher capacitance, I have to increase the area. If I want a higher capacitance, another thing I could do is decrease the spacing. The smaller D is, the bigger C is, right? What if I don't have a dielectric? How does that affect this formula? What if it's a vacuum? Okay, well that means that E is equal to E0 and kappa is equal to 1. So I should probably put an equal here and say kappa equals 1 for a vacuum. Just to highlight that. So if I don't have a dielectric, all I have to do is put that equal to 1, and that just gives me the capacitance without any material. So there's my capacitance. All right, I'm going to come down here and erase some stuff. All right, I want to put some numbers in, let's see. All right, so let's look at an example with some numbers. All right, let's say that I have 100 microfarad capacitor. Now, as you work with things, you'll get to see sizes of capacitors. Typically, they're small in numbers. You'll even get the tetracapacitor in the lab. That'll be exciting, right? Used to have these nice electrolytic capacitors, but now they just give you these little tiny, teeny ones, and that's quite as exciting. But let's say I have a capacitor that looks like that. Let's assume that the dielectric constant is 3. What are the units of dielectric constant?
Volts.
Okay. Well, let's see. How's it defined?
Electric field.
Electric field over electric field. No units, right? Not everything has a unit. But those things that do have units, I want to see the units. But in this case, there is no unit. Right? Sometimes people get bothered when they don't see a unit. Okay, so we have a dielectric constant of 3. If the distance between the two surfaces is 1.0 times 10 to the minus 5 meters, what is the surface area in order to have this capacitance? Okay, so this is purely about the structure of the capacitor. It has nothing to do with the voltage I put across the capacitor yet. I haven't done anything with it. Okay. So, C is equal to what? Kappa epsilon zero D over A.
Or A over D.
Or A over D. And then I want to solve this for A. And so A is going to be CD kappa epsilon zero. And we just have to throw some numbers in. Capacitance is 100 microfarads. What should I do with that?
Times 10 to the negative 6,
or I could combine that and make it 10 to the minus 4 farads. And then what do we have? D is 1 times 10 to the minus 5. Kappa?
3.
That's 3. That's nice and straightforward. So far, all the numbers look okay. Epsilon zero?
8.85
times 10 to the what?
Negative 12.
Negative 12. It's that epsilon zero that's going to kill us. So let's see, that's actually 10 to the minus 4. 10 to the minus 5, that's 10 to the minus 9. Bring up to 12, that's going to be a 10 to the minus plus 3. And then I have 1 over 3 times 8.85. So that's about 1 over, what, 25?
26.5.
About 1 over that. No?
Yeah.
It's what?
0.037.
Okay. 0.037. What is that? Is that this answer or is that this whole thing?
It's just 1.
No, that's just that times 10 to the third, which would be.
Okay. Just making sure we know how much you've computed. Do we agree with this? Yes, no?
Yes.
Yes? Okay, so what is my answer?
37.
37?
Yes.
You sure? Okay, are we comfortable? I mean, well, at least with the numbers before we think about it. Okay. So, of course, I made this up, but it can't be that far. I mean, you take these, you know, you have capacitances that are of this order, right? That distance might look a little bit small, but it's in the numerator, right? So it's not causing anything to be big. And I go through all the computation. It looks like 37. What are the units?
Meters squared.
Meters squared. That's an area, right? Okay, so the area of these plates would be 37 square meters. How big is that?
Pretty big.
Well, the square root of 37 is about 6, right? So that's, I made these up. I haven't computed this till just now, right? So it's nice that it's close to the perfect square. So it's like a 6 meter by 6 meters. How big is 6 meters? That's 3 of those 2 meter sticks, right? So 6 meters is, well, in feet. A meter is roughly 3 feet, well, bigger than 3 feet, right? So that's 18, so about 20 feet maybe, or more. So that's 20 by 20 feet. Right? And I'm going to use that in some device. Of course, if you read about how big computers used to be, right? The computing power, you're surprised, right? Of course, you're surprised that you're walking around these days with your iPhones, with your little, or whatever you have, with computing power more than the computing power they had when they went to the moon. All right? The reason is, you know, things have gotten smaller over the years, and we're able to compact more stuff into more space. But that's kind of ridiculous. And that's one of the reasons for doing a simple example like this, is to give you an idea that some of these areas can be a little disturbing. Yes?
Is epsilon zero always going to be that constant?
Yes. Epsilon zero is always that constant. However, if I take kappa times epsilon zero, people often call that epsilon, just as the electrical permittivity, not the electrical permittivity of free space. And then wherever there's an epsilon zero later, we can replace it with epsilons and discuss wave propagation, not in a vacuum, for example. Okay, so what other kinds of things can we do? One of the things that we mentioned is that capacitors store energy. So the last question we have to ask is, how much energy, okay, is stored? So I connect the battery across these, and I'm storing electrical energy. Okay, so the energy of course, the stored energy really is related to the amount of work that it's done, right? So the idea is when I connect the battery, if I take two plates with no charge, and I connect the battery across it, I begin to charge the plate up to its full capacity. So I go from some zero charge up to a maximum amount of charge, right? And that's essentially what the battery is doing. And so the battery is actually moving charge onto the plates. So I go from zero up to full charge, all right, establishing a potential difference across these plates. And so the amount of work that's done essentially is going to be the charge times the average potential difference that I get, right? Because I start assembling these charges, okay, we have to get that. Now the book does a little bit of hand waving. Well, it doesn't show any hands, but it's kind of hand waving. It says essentially we can write down that the average here, and this would take some thought, that the average I can write down as 1/2 the total potential, as I'm going from zero potential difference to the full potential difference. And so the book says, I can just write this as 1/2 QV with no bar. All right, bar meaning average. Okay, so the amount of work done to charge a capacitor is 1/2 the charge on the plate times the potential difference across the plate. And so that is the essential relationship. But we can do more with this because Q and V I could write in terms of the capacitance. All right, so Q is equal to CV, for example. I could come in here and say that this is 1/2 CV times V, or 1/2 CV squared. So the amount of work I could write in terms of the capacitance and the voltage. Now this makes some kind of sense because I can actually measure the voltage across the plates. Right? And so that's done in terms of measurable quantities. The capacitance is marked on the capacitor, or you can measure it using a meter. Get what the capacitance is. So it's very easy to figure out how much energy is stored. Or I could write it in terms of the charge. I could write this as 1/2 Q and instead rewrite V in terms of Q. So if I come back here, V is Q over C. So I could replace V with Q over C. So in both these cases, I'm just using Q equals CV. So what did I say? Q over C. So that's 1/2 Q squared over C. So there are different expressions. They all stem essentially from this one. Right? It's just a combination of that. It's not really three different expressions to memorize. Right? This is what the work is. If I know the relationship between Q and V, through the capacitance, and these can be rewritten. And that's precisely what I had done. Okay, but the middle one yields an interesting result, because I can write this as 1/2 CV squared. V, in the case of my parallel plates, can be written in terms of the electric field. I used this before, but I rewrote that. I wrote that E was V over D. And so if I have that E is V over D, oops, that doesn't even look like a D, or V is equal to E times D. If I plug that into this relationship, I get 1/2 C ED quantity squared. C, I can take all of that stuff that I derived before for C that's in the box. Notice there's a D in here, there's an A, and the epsilon zero, I can write this in terms of the dielectric constant. And there's a reason why I'm going to do that. I could stop right here and just make a point, but I'll proceed, because this formula yields something that I'm going to mention later in chapter, 24. So let's see. Let's plug in C. What is that? Kappa epsilon zero times the area divided by D, and then I have E squared D squared. Well, notice that one of the D's kills the other one. And the idea is that the work is proportional to the square of the electric field. But furthermore, A times D, if I look at the separation as D, and then I have the area of the plate, what is the area times that? What can we visualize? So I've got a region. I've got this area, and I have that span D. And if I multiply this area times the width here, what do I get?
Volume.
The volume. So combining this and the leftover D, I get a volume. So I could take the energy per, and I'm going to write vol, because if I throw a V in there, you'll have fits per volume, right? So the work per volume is equal to 1/2, and I'm left with a kappa epsilon zero E squared. So the energy, this is the energy density, right? Energy per volume, that's a density. So the energy density stored in an electric field is proportional to the square of the field. Where this comes in handy is that this is more general than just for parallel plates. This talks about the energy that's stored in an electric field, regardless of whether I have two parallel plates or not. I have some electric field, right? I have energy that's stored in it. All right, we're going to make use of that later. Okay. So this is just, at this point, this little discussion here is mostly an aside, something that I will refer to later when I talk about the energy stored in electromagnetic waves. Okay. So that concludes pretty much the discussion in this chapter. The next chapter, we are going to talk about electrical circuits. We're going to introduce things like resistance, current, and put resistors and capacitors together in the circuits and describe the kinds of things we can measure.